I'm Nahla Ayed, host of Ideas. In this age of clickbait and online shouting, Ideas is a meeting ground for people who want to deepen their understanding of the world. Join me as we crack open a concept to see how it plays out over place and time and how it matters today. From the rise of authoritarianism to the history of cult movies, no idea is off limits. Ideas is on the CBC Listen app or wherever you find your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Therapists love a good metaphor, and you can see why. When you take a big challenge in your life and reframe it, turn it into a story, it can feel more manageable. Say you're burned out, exhausted. A good psychologist might remind you, you can't drink from a well that's run dry. In other words, it's time to replenish your well. Then there's the ever-popular oxygen mask on the airplane metaphor. When your life hits turbulence, remember, you have to fasten your own oxygen mask first, or you won't be able to help anybody else. And then, okay, this one's my favorite. Life is like a road that you travel on.
Love's like a road that you travel on when there's one day. Next day gone, sometimes you bend, sometimes you stand, sometimes you turn your back to the wind.
Sometimes you do have to turn your back to the wind. Tom Cochran, therapist extraordinaire. The point is, metaphors can do some of the heavy lifting when you're trying to work through a messy chapter in your life. So what if therapists found a way to bring all those symbols to life in a really tangible way? Say hello to mixed reality therapy. John Francis Leader is a psychologist and cognitive scientist. He works at the intersection of psychology and technology at University College Dublin.
And you can literally have, and we've done this many times, have a person there at a crossroads, literally, where they're standing there. And there's something really amazing about that, just to be there and to go a slightly different direction than maybe you've gone in previous moments. And what's so lovely about that is it's so real. It's a felt experience in your body. So you really remember it and it really resonates. It's not just a conceptual, intellectual thing. You've actually done it. So it feels nice.
John Francis Leader describes the approach as theme park meets therapy. And he says one of its most poignant applications is helping people go back to a special place, virtually, at the end of their lives.
One of the uses for the technology in this way is kind of both sad and beautiful at the same time, which is often when it comes to end-of-life care, you know, and people maybe can't leave their bed, but, you know, still want to have experiences in their life. One memory that comes to mind of working with somebody who the forest was particularly meaningful for them, but certain forests aren't particularly accessible, and it was somewhere they'd spent time as a child. And the realization that they couldn't go there again, not only was it soothing to go to, but it was kind of poignant as well, kind of realizing that they couldn't.
John Francis Leader, taking therapy to the next level, coming up. Later this hour, meet Faye Nugent. For years, she had a serious fear of heights. The simple act of getting on an escalator, terrifying.
It started to interfere with my day-to-day life. I was having problems with escalators, and escalators are everywhere. I was at an airport with some colleagues in the Netherlands, and my colleagues were heading towards an escalator with luggage to go down and go to check-in. And I just had to follow them, and I was terrified. And I thought, this has got to stop now.
Then one day, Faye Nugent heard about a clinical trial for virtual reality therapy at Oxford University, and she gave it a try. Faye's story later this hour. This is Tapestry. I'm Mary Hines. John Francis Leader is a psychologist at University College Dublin. He specializes in the place where psychology and technology meet. He is the director of the Mixed Reality Therapy Research Project. John Francis Leader is my guest. Hello to you.
Hello, Mary. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for being here. Now, before you worked in psychology, you were involved in the world of filmmaking, and I was surprised to hear that you're calling on some of the same tools, some of the same skill set. Tell me a little bit about that crossover.
I think I felt from a fairly young age that experiences and storytelling and narrative and that type of thing was just very appealing to me. But that doesn't solve the problem, I suppose, of what you should do with your life. So I started off, I loved watching films and television and the storytelling involved in that. And that led me to get into filmmaking, which I loved and still love. It's still part of what I do. And I realized that really psychology was what I was really interested in, and helping people to have experiences that help change how they think and feel and act. So that was kind of my path.
A lot of your work in therapy makes use of virtual reality, and more accurately, mixed reality. And I don't think I'd ever come across that term. What would be a concrete example to help me out with this? What's mixed reality in the context of therapy?
To be very fair as well to the question, it's a very emerging field. But at its core, mixed reality is a combination of three things, I suppose. It's recognizing that when we have an experience, and this is different than, it's like if you're watching a film, there's a difference between hearing about the plot of the film versus actually watching it and having an experience and having it resonate with you. Broadly speaking, there are three kind of main ways we tend to engage. One is physically. So that's where you go in the old-fashioned sense to a real-world location and you engage and you interact with it. And then the other one, of course, is the imagination. If you're doing something like reading a book, you're not going to a beach, but you're reading about the waves and this feeling of the sand beneath your feet, and you're having a sense of that. And radio, of course, would be another example of a medium that evokes imagination, but still it's using real audio. So there's a bit of a spectrum of you know, how you do this. And that's kind of where the virtual sits. It's kind of somewhere between the physical and the imagination. And there are lots of different forms of it. It may be virtual reality in the form of a head-mounted display that a person wears and they can look around the space that they're in. Or it may be just a simple screen. Or in some ways, it can be the tools that are used in things like play therapy, where somebody uses sand or something like that to create a scene that represents something meaningful for them in a therapeutic sense. Or art therapy is another form. So it can be very high-tech or it can be very low-tech. That's what's interesting. So mixed reality is really any combination of the physical, the virtual, and the imaginary. And then mixed reality therapy is how can we use those tools to scaffold and to support therapy and to make it more effective and also more enjoyable and interesting and engaging for people.
Well, tell me about a time then when some sort of mixed reality setting helped a patient deal with something, helped a patient arrive at some kind of healing in a therapeutic setting.
So while sometimes it can be very simple and just being there with the person is enough, oftentimes, though, we can do a lot more than that. And that's what's exciting about using the mixed reality technology. So if we think of some of the examples of how it's used, one easier, I suppose, example to think of is with phobias. So when somebody has anxiety around something, very often encountering or interacting with that particular thing, as uncomfortable as it can seem at first, is a very important part of the therapeutic process, some form of exposure therapy, or sometimes even just skill development. And if you think of the example of where this is kind of traditionally already used, something like learning to be an airline pilot would be a good example. Because they will fly in real physical aircraft and they will use flight simulators and they'll probably spend a bit of time imagining it too. So it's almost a similar approach, I suppose, to therapy. So if somebody had social anxiety, might be one, you know, good concrete example of that. Certainly spending time interacting with other people physically would be good and useful, but that might be hard to do because, of course, they're anxious to begin with, and it's hard to control and even set up and arrange a room of other people, and it's awkward and it's difficult. So to some degree, imaginal work can be done where they can maybe do a bit of visualization with that, which can be helpful. But that's where the virtual can be very handy, because you can create a scene that has other characters, other people in it, and the person can maybe put on the virtual reality headset or they can just look at it on a screen, or we can use projectors, or like Disneyland does, you can have a combination of the projection and then the physical set as well. And they can be in that place and they can practice maybe making eye contact a bit more with somebody, which would have been very hard to practice otherwise. Not too much, not too little. Little subtle things like that that are difficult to practice. And the other thing the virtual offers is a lot of ability to control the environment. So maybe if they're feeling uncomfortable, to pause the simulation and just to stop and to kind of be there, to pause time for a moment to help them process how they're feeling. Mm. Because it could be, for example, with somebody with social anxiety, that part of why they're feeling that way is maybe a challenging previous experience they've had. So being able to stop like that and then talk about that and then work with any previous challenges around that and then maybe continue can be a nice way to go. Mm. So things like phobias are probably a good example. Things like fear of heights would be another classic one, where you can walk out on top of a large multi-story building, which is not something that's easy to arrange necessarily in real life. And in a simple and in a systematic way, help them to understand how they're feeling and find better ways of working with it.
So if my challenge is social anxiety, are the stakes a bit lower if I'm confronting a room full of people in a virtual setting and I can press the pause button and be in control to a certain degree? Is this idea of the stakes not being quite as high helpful in this scenario?
Yeah, I think that's a good way of looking at it. And it's interesting because one of the other areas, my research, I'm based out in University College Dublin in Ireland. And one of the things our research program looks at there in the psychology department is horror movies and, you know, why people like that kind of thing. And some of the research around that suggests something very much like what you said, which is that we kind of like the combination of the safety, but the thrill of it as well. Mm. So it's knowing that it's not real on some level. But what, of course, the big outstanding question was in this area, and gladly we've had a good bit of research to help us answer this, is that, is it effective if it's not real? You know, do we need to really believe that we're there? But what's really interesting is we tend to, on an emotional level, really, we do believe that we're there. And you see that even when you watch a horror movie, that kind of logically you might tell yourself it's not real, but your body on an emotional and on a visceral level, it still has the response as if you are in a danger situation. So that means virtual reality and other forms of simulation can actually be rather effective at helping to kind of regulate our emotions for that reason.
And was that an open question for a while? Because it strikes me that's a really important thing for the research to have arrived at. Is it still effective if it's not, you know, quote unquote, real? Was that up in the air for a while?
Well, probably not for too long. I think any of us, like yourself and myself, who have any media background, kind of knew instinctively that it's not up for debate. Because, I mean, radio is a perfect example of this. Because, you know, somebody could argue that compared to virtual reality technology and simulators or projectors, that you could say radio is an old-fashioned medium. But there's a reason why it's as in as it ever has been, is because it's amazing how evocative it is to engage our attention in a story. And I mean, even reading a book is just black text and white paper. But wow, you know, a well-told story in that form is absolutely captivating on an emotional level.
And you are there, in a sense, when you're caught up in a good book.
100%. Mm. 100%. And this is in the research, this is this idea of presence, really presence research. What is it to be there, engaged, engrossed in something? And what's interesting is it doesn't seem to have much to do in a way with how kind of complex or how even immersive the simulation or the technology is. It's more to do with the narrative, how relevant it is to the person and how meaningful it is. Now, the reason why, to answer your question, there was kind of ongoing discussion about what is needed to make a good experience and how effective, is because, to be fair, there's maybe different needs, I suppose, in different simulations. You sometimes are trying to develop skills in a particular environment. So sometimes, like for the airline pilot in that simulation example, you need to be able to interact with the controls and almost develop the muscle memory of doing that. So there's no point in making maybe a very realistic looking aircraft, but you can't interact with the controls. So there's kind of different types of presence and realism. So similarly in therapy, sometimes we're trying to do skill development, like actually help a person practice developing social skills. But other times we're trying to help them to work with emotions, which are maybe a little bit more abstract. And sometimes what we do with that is we actually, like a good example of this would be working with post-traumatic stress, which is an increasingly popular use of virtual technology. And it's become a kind of a convention in the research and practice in this area to actually shy away from photorealism and trying to kind of recreate something that was traumatic for obvious reasons. And actually to represent it in much simpler ways can sometimes be a bit more effective. We had one example of that when we were testing the platform we're working on, where we had, it was actually one of the experts involved who had very much a technology background rather than psychology, but you know, he was sharing this experience as we were working on it, of being attacked in an alleyway, you know, so a very challenging experience. So he felt the need to process it and kind of work through it. But rather than the difficulty of trying to recreate that environment perfectly, we used just some very simple geometric shapes to create the sense of the space. And he was able to stand between them. So this is in 3D, wearing a virtual reality headset. And he had that feeling of kind of the enclosure of it. So that was the pertinent part of it for him. It wasn't the photorealism of it, it was the feeling of the space of between those two walls. And then what we were able to do is we were able to process how he was feeling, but actually make the walls a little bit smaller and a little bit further apart. So there was a feeling of kind of progressing beyond that, so that then afterwards it didn't feel like as big a thing for him. It was still there, but a bit smaller, and he was able to talk about it a bit more easily. So things like that.
Well, that's so interesting. Do you find you're walking a fine line with this? You want to evoke a troubling experience, but in a way that's perhaps none too real?
Yep. And that's the challenging role of being a therapist, is hitting that balance. It really is. But it's not necessarily as hard as it seems when you do it in a very collaborative way with the client or the patient in real time. I think that's really the key. So there's different views about this when it comes to developing technology. For example, some companies will develop apps that people can use themselves and, you know, things like that. And that's very valid in certain contexts. But what we focus on a bit more is more creating tools that really assist just good quality interaction between the client and the therapist rather than replace it. So it's a bit like the autopilot on the aircraft. You still have a pilot, you know, in that way. And I think that's important because that helps solve that problem. So if you're really collaborating with the client, it's a challenge, but it's not as hard as it would seem because you've really built up that rapport. You're working with each other. You're pulling back and pushing forward based on the client's needs.
You're with Tapestry. Thanks for inviting us in. Whether it's on podcast, on the CBC Listen app, or on CBC Radio 1. A fear of heights? You'd have plenty of company. Roughly 1 in 5 people live with this particular anxiety. And for 1 person out of 20, that fear reaches the height, no pun intended, of a clinical diagnosis, acrophobia. So for someone like Faye Nugent, simply getting on an escalator is an insurmountable challenge. It was time to get help. And as Faye worked to address her fear of heights, she found herself in some unexpected places.
The shopping centre filled with water and a killer whale came along, and I had to stand on its nose while it swam round the shopping centre. You couldn't see the water. It was like the whale was swimming through air. But you did feel very off balance, and you felt like at any time the whale could change direction and you would topple off. My name is Faye Nugent. I'm a transformation project manager in local government in the UK. I'm 52 years old. The earliest memory I have of my fear of heights is when I went away on a weekend with some friends. I was probably in my early 30s, And we decided as part of this weekend to do some adventure activities, which involved climbing up a pole and then walking out across ropes at different heights. And when it came to walk across the rope, I just couldn't do it. When I was in a situation at heights, the feelings that I encountered were feeling dizzy, an overwhelming sense of concern for people around me. So, for example, I was in a theatre, I was quite high up. There were women there in high heels. I was worried about them falling over. They were drinking. I was thinking, well, they've had too much to drink, they're going to fall over. It started to interfere with my day-to-day life. I was having problems with escalators, and escalators are everywhere. I was at an airport with some colleagues in the Netherlands, and my colleagues were heading towards an escalator with luggage to go down and go to check-in, and I just had to follow them, and I was terrified, and I thought, this has got to stop now. I was driving home from work one day and there was an advert on the radio for the University of Oxford. They were looking for people like me who had a fear of heights. They'd got this new VR technology. They were running a clinical trial and they wanted participants to try the new technology to see if it helped them. I thought, well, this is it. This is something that I can try. To try and get back to some sort of normality in my day-to-day life.
We're talking about 20 years of avoiding escalators and balconies. How much of that can really be solved by putting on a VR headset? You'll hear from Faye again a little later. My guest is John Francis Leader from University College Dublin. Well, one of the other tools in your toolkit touches on the idea of providing comfort. So if someone comes to you, someone is under a lot of stress, you might ask that person whether there's a place that would help them to feel better, some place they'd like to go, even if that setting is virtual. What are some of the places or some of the states of mind people request when you're working with them? What brings them to a place of a little more peace?
Yeah, that's a great question. And one of the uses for the technology in this way is kind of both sad and beautiful at the same time, which is often when it comes to end of life care, you know, and people maybe who can't leave their bed, but, you know, still want to have experiences in their life. You know, it's a real privilege to be able to help people in that position. Sad as it is, it's also very inspiring because there may be somewhere they'd like to go, but they literally can't in any practical, functional sense. So the use of virtual technology is very nice in that way for them to be given that ability to choose. And increasingly what's happening as we collaborate a bit more, our mixed reality therapy project, we've built it as an open source project, meaning that it's not owned by anyone in particular. It's a kind of collaborative thing.
Yes.
And one of the main reasons we did that, other than it being a nice thing to do, is that it really opens up development a lot more so that we're trying to tie in to different resources and databases and assets that exist. So what this means is for some people, it might be a beach that they want to go to. So, you know, existing content may be there, 360 degree videos or photos, etc. And we have this mixed reality therapy room, which is kind of like a space that we always start from, kind of a secure base. And then from there, we can build on extra content. We have an adjoining room that as the person moves into that, it can be that beach that they talked about, if that was meaningful for them. Mm. Sometimes it's a bit more fantasy. Other times it's a real world location, maybe a place they grew up. And using the kind of technologies like of Google Street View and various other databases of photo imagery, there's room to tap into that and bring them to those real locations, or to let them even design a space sometimes, which is a place for them that's right, and to kind of drag and drop in an interactive sense. So that's a very nice use of it in terms of, yeah, the supportive, calming environments. Places that create a sense of safety and calm are probably some of the big themes.
You said something really interesting a minute ago, that this could also be a fantasy setting. How might that help? It's not just me wanting to go back to the street where I grew up, but it's me wanting to go to, you know, I don't know, Lothlorien or something in Middle Earth.
Yeah, exactly. It's really all of the above. Or you have variants as well, which are based on reality, but slightly modified in a way that's supportive for the person too, which is a kind of an interesting mix. So the point really is to create a canvas, I suppose, a kind of an experiential canvas where there's a lot of control given to the client and the therapist is there to support them. The kind of cinema example of this is, for any Matrix fans, is the role of Neo, who's, you know, in this simulation in the space, and then the role of Morpheus, who's this kind of guide or support, you know, trying to help him work through it. So this is the kind of the relationship between client and therapist in the space. And sometimes it'll be incredibly minimalistic. Like sometimes it'll be as simple as geometric shapes. If somebody's saying they're feeling anxious, you might say, well, what shape would that be? Is it a square? Is it a sphere? Is it like a cube? What is it? What color would that be? What size is it for you? And how can we make that bigger or make it smaller? You know, how can we stand closer to it or move further from it? What would be another feeling that might be a nice kind of antidote or counterbalance to that? Maybe a feeling of ease. What does that look like? How do the two relate together? So sometimes it'll start off in very simple ways, that canvas. And remember that this is in three dimensions. So a person can move around the space and there's motion trackers so they can pick these shapes up and interact with them and move around. And then they may build from there and they might say, okay, well, actually, what about an environment that helps me with those feelings? And this is where they might mention a forest or a place that they've had a particular experience. That is one memory that comes to mind of working with somebody who the forest was particularly meaningful for them, but forests, particularly certain forests, aren't particularly accessible. And it was somewhere they'd spent time as a child. And the realization that they couldn't go there again, you know, in and of itself was a problem. And not only was it soothing to go to, but it was kind of poignant as well, kind of realizing that they couldn't. So it was a kind of nice two-in-one in a way to be able to overcome the sadness of not being able to go there, but also to bring the qualities of that location. So when you're doing that kind of work, you have a couple of options. You can recreate it. So they can actually place trees and create the space again themselves. Or you can try and actually bring in the real location as well. So as we collaborate with different technologies, that gets a bit easier to be able to draw on content that exists of different real world locations and to be able to make use of them.
I'm struck here by the potential bit of tension between seeking out comfort and needing to confront something that's been difficult in your past. I'm thinking of the person in the alley who's trying to relive an attack, but not in a sense that is too uncomfortable or too photorealistic. As a therapist, how do you know when to guide someone towards comfort versus guiding that person towards a more painful confronting of something from the past?
Yeah, it's a very good question. And it's a kind of an existential question in life itself, I suppose, for all of us, isn't it, to some degree?
Right, right.
A big part of it, I think, is in how the whole experience is framed and the processes and the supports around it to begin with. And that was one of the reasons why, because the Mixed Reality Therapy Project kind of has two parts to it. One is a piece of software, a platform we're developing that, you know, again, it's open source, so we're giving it to clinics to use and, you know, people to practice and people to build on and researchers to develop. So it's kind of an ongoing living project in that sense. But the other piece of it, which is just as important as the software or the simulation system, is just the processes around it. It's the workflow, as you're saying, of how do you do this and when is too much and when is too little.
Right, right.
So one of the things, for example, that we have put a lot of work, almost the main work into, is making it so that if something is a phobic object, for example, is that it won't appear where it shouldn't. There won't be a bug or a glitch, you know, in that way, that it can be carefully managed by the client and the therapist. So there's a lot of kind of safeguards around that. And we also really carefully designed the simulation so that it's actually built with two rooms generally. So for a person who uses it, they come into a regular physical room in a clinic or wherever the setting will be. And they sit down on a chair. It looks much like a regular therapy room. And then there are different forms of this, because you can use projection or virtual reality headsets, or you could even just use a simple 2D screen like you would almost playing a video game. So it's designed to be flexible because different locations have different needs. But if we take the example of the virtual reality headset as a good example of it, when they then put on that virtual reality headset, having first talked to the therapist, of course, and clarified why they're there and, you know, the background work has already been done, they find themselves immediately in a room which is exactly like the room they were already physically in, but a virtual version of it.
Hmm.
Now, in some ways, that's strange, because the whole point of simulation is something different or something unusual than the real. But the reason we did that was, building on the research on this, was that if we can ground the person in already feeling uncomfortable, kind of create a bridge between the physical and the virtual, so it's not that strange and fantastical and unusual. There's already a sense of safety in that space. There's nothing different other than the fact they're wearing the headset. There's nothing different about the space. It's mapped exactly into the dimensions of the room they're already in. And when we're doing installations, this can be calibrated to the actual room. So if you were to walk over to the wall, you can feel it. It's where you expect it to be. Mm. The sofa is included. Everything's built in. But the reason for that then is, we have then an adjoining room, which we call the experience room. And that's deliberately kept separate from the main consultancy room, so that what we start to do is we start to say, okay, what is it that you'd like to work with? And if you imagine it's on the other side of that door, which is closed, what would it be? Is it that calming space? And if so, what is that? Or is it something more challenging that you want to work with? And what is that? And what's really interesting is, before you even get near going into that other room, just that sense of referring to X, whatever it might be, is really therapeutically useful and allows a good bit of work to be done before it even gets particularly experiential. And that can be done at an appropriate pace. And then you kind of know if a person's right. And we find a lot of the work actually happens just walking up to the door and not even opening it, but standing there and talking about it. And then maybe opening the door a little and looking in and closing it and going back and sitting down again.
Mm.
So you've got this real secure base that you're building on. And then, where appropriate, moving into the other room when the person is ready at their own pace. So I think that pacing and the supports around it, it's a very important part of the process, rather than just having a good experience, but it's in isolation. The before and the after, the process, we find it really matters.
I'm envisioning this door as being both physical and symbolic. You know, there's something about a threshold that's being crossed.
Yes.
That's quite poetic.
It is. And that was actually one of the reasons I wanted to do it, because it felt nice and poetic and in that way. And there's some research about that. I write about the symbolic sense of changing spaces and changing mental states in that way. And just from a behavioral conditioning perspective, there's a lot of research on that, this was a big thing during the pandemic when people were trying to maybe work from home, you know, and if you're mixing different functions in the same space, it can be hard.
Yes, yeah.
So to have different spaces for different things is good. And then, of course, you can retreat back to a place which is established as being secure, and that's always kept kind of safe. And there's the sanctity of that space is kind of good practice.
This is Tapestry, keeping you company and helping you make sense of the world. If you're listening online at cbc.ca, hello to you. You can also find us on the CBC Listen app, on Spotify, on Sirius XM Satellite Radio, and on CBC Radio 1. I'm Mary Hines. Let's check on Faye Nugent. Faye was struggling with a serious fear of heights until she heard about a program at Oxford University involving VR therapy.
I was asked to come to a very ordinary looking office in Oxford. And on the day, they took me to an escalator in a shopping centre in Oxford and asked me to go on it. And they were going to film me going down an escalator. And I saw the cameraman holding a camera. He was going to go backwards on the escalator in front of me, and I was just supposed to step onto this escalator, and I literally could not do it. I was scared for myself. I was scared for him. So from there, they took me back to the office where I undertook the treatment. And what the treatment was putting on a VR headset. I was also given a hand to hold that was like a grabber and put into the VR world. The world was very cartoon-like, very blocky. It didn't feel like real life at all. But amazingly, the tasks provoked a sense of fear in me. The way it works is you go into the shopping centre has 10 floors, and on each floor you undertake a different task, and the tasks get progressively harder as you rise up through the shopping centre. The mall looked like a big US style shopping mall. It was very modern. It had clear balconies. It had escalators in it. You were around the edge of the mall, so it had quite a big space in the middle, and all your activities took place over this big space. The initial task was just leaning over a balcony, so that was quite simple, but the task got progressively more difficult and progressively more frightening. I had to do things like rescue a cat from a tree. I had to walk out over a rickety railway line. And the final task, which is the most terrifying of all, was bizarrely the shopping centre filled with water, and a killer whale came along, and I had to stand on its nose while it swam round the shopping centre. You couldn't see the water. It was like the whale was swimming through air, but you did feel very off balance, and you felt like at any time the whale could change direction and you would topple off. And all the while I was feeling quite frightened, and it was the same fear that I always experienced when doing something at height. My heart would beat faster, I'd feel anxious, I'd feel a bit sweaty. But at the same time, I knew I was in an office, even though I was in the VR environment and things felt very real to me. I also knew that I was in an office and I was completely safe. And so although I'd start off having these initial feelings of fear, quite quickly the feelings subsided.
Faye completed the 4-hour virtual reality exposure therapy, but she had no idea whether it was going to work. Skeptical might be the word. You'll hear from Faye again later this hour. I'm struck by how practical a lot of this is, how deeply practical. And it reminds me of an aspect of your work you've talked about, that there is potentially a similar way of looking at psychotherapy and physiotherapy. You know, you want to see results. You want it to work.
Yep.
Tell me about that link with physiotherapy.
It's probably the easiest way of describing, I suppose, the parallel, because I think we get it with physiotherapy. Like if you went for a session of physiotherapy and if you talked about your body for an hour and then left, you'd feel a bit disappointed. you kind of expect this next part always, aren't you? When are they going to get me to stand up and to move and so forth? So I like to think it's similar psychologically. Now, again, I always add that the point of having tools is not to use them all the time. Imagine hiring a tradesperson that, you know, walks in, you know, with their drill in hand, using it actively all the time, or their hammer out all the time. The skill and the nuance is putting them all away, but being able to draw on any of them when they're needed. So sometimes, yes, just stopping and listening is all you needed. But for some people, that's exactly the opposite. They're kind of feeling frustrated with sitting there and being heard, and they want to act differently, or they need the scaffolding and the support to be able to access certain emotions and states and work with them. So that's where the parallel to physio is. It kind of makes sense, because you will do work that's quite experiential. And a lot of psychological work does build a form of muscle tone, just like working on muscles builds muscle tone. Mm. You know, sometimes it's not our fault that we can't lift a particular thing. It's just that our body isn't conditioned in that particular way. And that's a good example of scaffolding as well, because when you go for physiotherapy, you can move, but you can also use tools like steps or a balance board or things like that, a scaffolding to help the process. So it's very, very similar, really, if you think about applied experiential psychological therapy, that, you know, what are the tools we can bring in to help people encounter certain experiences or go certain places that can be helpful. And it's also important to appreciate that it's not that these principles themselves are new. We've had all kinds of eclectic therapies from the 60s and the 70s and way before that and way after. After that, and art therapy and drama therapy and lots of really good things. But I think we were in a nice time now, though, where some of these tools are becoming a bit more accessible. And it's nice to be able to use technology for good in that way. And it's another nice new form of scaffolding that can sometimes more practically help draw the pieces together.
Is there ever an aspect of corrective work to this? So if I'm reliving a challenging moment from my past or something that was painful, I'm thinking of that British Army Land Rover. Would I ever be put in the driver's seat and I don't go down the alley that was that, you know, brought me to disaster, or I turn left instead of turning right, or I'm really careful to avoid that tree? Is there a concept of having a do-over and landing in a better place?
Yeah, that's a very nice point. And this is where a narrative therapy, in a way, kind of meets applied and experiential therapy, because a lot of it is that, all right. It's these moments in time. It's these doorways we walk through. It's these kind of choice points and these options. But very often, as a rule of thumb with previous experiences and the idea of do-overs, absolutely, it can be a very valid and empowering thing. But usually, as part of that therapeutic work, we try to not really change the past in any way, to help accept that, but to almost learn from it. And I suppose to take something that's empowering from the experience so that they do feel empowered to do it again, but still with the hindsight and the benefit of that experience. Because there's a sense in the good things in life, but also the challenges in life, actually really helping us to have the wisdom that we have today. Mm-hmm. So we never want to kind of detract from that point. But there's no reason why you can't have both. You know, we can do a bit of work to learn from the past, process any challenges that need to be processed, to take maybe some good learning moving forward, and then do that do-over and to say, what would that look like? And you can literally have, and we've done this many times, have a person there at a crossroads, literally, where they're standing there. And, you know, we've often discussed beforehand what those different paths are and what they look like. And there's something really amazing about that, just to be there and to turn one direction instead of the other, and to go a slightly different direction than maybe you've gone in previous moments. And what's so lovely about that is it's so real. It's a felt experience in your body. So you really remember it and it really resonates. It's not just a conceptual, intellectual thing. You've actually done it. So it feels nice.
And that's where the virtual aspect of this comes in. I feel as though I'm literally standing at a crossroads.
Exactly. And you could do that physically. You can get them in a car and bring them to the crossroads somewhere. But, you know, when you get to the crossroads, of course, that might be difficult. There might be traffic. There might be other people there. It mightn't look like they imagined it. So this is where the virtual is handy. It's convenient.
It cleans the whole thing up for them a little bit.
It does.
It's a bit more manageable. You know, I don't want to be fishing around for free therapy here, John Francis, but I just have one question. As quite a claustrophobic person, I'm often asked, why is it that I've watched literally every submarine movie ever made in the history of cinema? And I mean every submarine movie ever made. Am I doing some kind? It's not self-soothing because they scare the hell out of me. But is that a kind of exposure therapy that you see people voluntarily choose from time to time?
Well, when we're building our submarine simulator, I know who to come for advice.
Oh, jeez.
But you're absolutely right. So often what happens is when we feel anxious about something, anxiety comes usually from a very good place. It's a safety mechanism. It's you know, while there are forms of course, that are maladaptive, at the same time, though, you know, we need to appreciate it's a human emotion that for many thousands of years has kept us and our ancestors safe in very challenging situations. So very very often what's needed there is to build a better relationship rather than battling it, and to kind of calibrate it, I suppose, you know, because your system, whatever the specifics are, it tends to try and keep us safe. So that, interestingly, that tendency for people who have a phobia or a concern of something to be particularly interested in it is one of the interesting features, actually, of mixed reality therapy, because it often is actually quite interesting and compelling for people for that reason. As a therapy, it's just kind of interesting beyond even the effectiveness of it, because there's something interesting about being in that space and facing it. One of the things I work in is I collaborate here in Dublin with a local airline pilot who runs a fear of flying course. So he looks after the practical elements of it in terms of how flights work. And I look after the psychology side of it, and we do it together. And what's interesting is we're doing it in a real airport, and we're using a flight simulator. So very similar to what you described, people are fascinated to, you know, understand how the controls work and how to make it work and not work and to really explore it. And yeah, that's something I hear a lot. There's a lot of expertise there in that. So what we want to do with that is embrace that, but I suppose bring it somewhere in a useful way, because often we're in a holding pattern, I suppose, with our phobia. And, you know, it's probably a feeling that if we understand something, that will make us safer. But sometimes, of course, it doesn't. We're kind of rehearsing or practicing the challenge to some extent. So to help progress through that, then, is the role of the therapy. And how that's done will vary quite a bit, because there often are different reasons, whether it's claustrophobia or anything else. There tend to be different backstories there. So we want to kind of understand and appreciate that and then build scaffolding that can help work with that in an appropriate way.
But that's really interesting. If you are merely rehearsing your fear, you're not getting anywhere.
Yeah. And that's the point of the mixed reality. When we say there's the physical, the virtual, and the imaginal, the imagination, you know, it can be as powerful as the other two. So it's not one versus the other. That's the point. It's some combination. And very often somebody's doing a form of mental rehearsal using imagination, and it's very powerful. And the problem is whether they've had real life experiences of a challenge, they've imagined it so many times that it feels like they've had thousands of challenging experiences. And on a neurological level, what that's doing is each time we're imagining that outcome, good or bad, it's forming synaptic connections in the brain. It's like the muscle tone in physiotherapy. We're kind of building the muscle of having that fear a little bit more. And it comes from a good place. It's an attempt to control and to understand and to be safe. So that's why it's nice in the therapeutic work to kind of meet that need, but to bring it somewhere useful and constructive. And what can create a bad habit can create a good habit. What can create a fear can usually create a sense of ease as well, if it's worked with.
There's a saying of yours I've really been drawn to. It's this idea that therapy is too important to leave to the therapists. What kind of teamwork are you envisioning here?
Yeah, so it's been a real fun part of this project, because, you know, I think a lot of us who are drawn to this type of work, it's, you know, I think inevitably a vocation rather than just a profession. You know, it's something that you feel passionate about, and a little knowledge goes a long way. And I think there's something very true of psychological well-being that a lot of the time we're just not taught how our systems work. So the problem is that if we leave it until it's severe, or if it's a big challenge, that's not good for the community, but it's also not good for specialists who are located in a hospital, for example, who have a big waiting list of people to see. So I like to think that a lot of the technology can be supportive of that, but also a lot of people can be involved. So the mixed reality therapy development, actually developing the software and the platforms and the processes, that itself is fascinating, because obviously psychologists like myself involved, but then various types of technologists, various types of creative design people, people who work with art installations, you know, so there's this real ecosystem of kind of art and science coming together. I mean, it sounds kind of utopian or something, but it's happening, and it's lovely. It's really nice. And what's lovely about it is everybody's kind of got a different piece of the jigsaw. So it's really nice to have that kind of integration between people. And then, of course, beyond that, the point is to empower people individually and on a community level to be able to use some of these tools. I'd really encourage people people just in a simple way. Obviously, if you need any proper support, go see a professional and get appropriate advice. But it can be nice just to have that lens in a way of how am I engaging with the physical, the virtual, and the imaginal? And how can I kind of curate almost my experiential diet is the way I like to think about it. How can I have more of certain content that's uplifting for me and maybe less of things that actually just make me feel bad within myself and be a little bit more mindful and deliberate in how we do things? So definitely psychology is far too important to be left as psychologists. We can have a role in helping to make sure the standards are high and that side of things. But this needs to be something we all practice and, you know, support each other with, I think.
It's really good to talk to you. John Francis Leader, thank you.
A pleasure. Thank you so much.
John Francis Leader is a psychologist and cognitive scientist. He works at the intersection of psychology and technology at University College Dublin. John Francis Leader spoke to you from Dublin. After 4 hours of chasing cats and riding orcas, Faye's fear of heights was going to be put to the test back at the same escalator she could not step on that morning.
I knew the final task that I was going to be given that day was to go back to the shopping centre that I'd been to in the morning and go on the same escalator that I'd tried to get on in the morning with the same cameraman filming me. And I can remember walking towards the shopping centre with the research coordinator and the cameraman thinking, I'm going to look really silly here. I'm going to be the only person that this hasn't worked for. I'm not going to be able to get on this escalator again. And I just remember feeling upset for them, really, that their intervention wasn't going to have worked on me. So we went to the shopping centre and they said to me, right now, we want you to try and get on the escalator again. And the cameraman got on backwards the way he had done before. And the time came for me to step onto the escalator. And I just got on it without a second thought. And I just thought, I don't understand what's happened here. My feelings from this morning, all the anxieties have just completely gone. And how's that happened? I've been in an office for a few hours playing a game and I can get on an escalator. What's going on? The study had helped me because it had basically reset my perception of risk in my brain, which had originally been set too low. So I would anticipate risks at heights before anybody else would be thinking about them, and it had reset them to a normal level. So I was advised to make sure I kept challenging that. Which is what I did. I just took every opportunity to go on escalators again and make sure I was looking down while I was on them, which was the thing that scared me before. And one of the things that had always stopped me doing is I'd always wanted to try skiing. So I went to the Alps with a friend and yeah, no problems at all. I still have a healthy appreciation for risk at heights. It doesn't make you do things that are going to be dangerous. It doesn't get rid of all your fear of heights, but what it does do is take your fear down to a normal level in line with other people's. The impact of the VR therapy on my life has been huge. I can go shopping with my daughter and not worry about there being escalators in the shopping centres. I can travel and not worry about escalators on metros or in airports. I mean, skiing is just something I've always wanted to try, and it took me to the grand old age of 51 to take my first skiing lesson, but I did it and I love it, and that's something I would have missed out on. It was something that was just 4 hours out of my life that has probably been one of the most beneficial 4 hours I've ever spent doing anything. And for saying that I'd probably for 20 years had issues that were getting progressively worse, for it to just take 4 hours to resolve that, I just think is amazing.
That was Faye Nugent, whose life turned around in just 4 hours with VR therapy, thanks to Oxford VR. Faye lives in Oxfordshire, in the UK. That's it for us this week. This episode was produced by McKenna Hadley-Burke and Samir Chabra. Thanks to our intern, Theo Van Buzekom. Technical production by Laura Antonelli. The senior producer is Rosie Fernandez. I'm Mary Hines. Thank you for listening.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.